Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to raise kids in the 21st century? The list of the right things to do seems to get longer by the year, expanding now to include prenatal music, baby sign language classes for hearing kids, and of course any number of sports, performance, and academic classes designed to enrich children's lives and enhance their potential. But is it actually working? My guest today would argue we are instead creating a generation of frazzled and unhappy kids who have every luxury and advantage except the time to develop without management from well-meaning adults. Carl Honoré's new book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Carl, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What is hyperparenting?
Well, hyperparenting is really good parenting run amok or gone too far. It starts from a very noble and natural place, which is the instinct to do the best for our children. But over the last generation, that has tipped into something like caricature, so that now as parents, we feel under pressure to push, polish, and protect our children with superhuman zeal. We want to give them the best of everything and make them at the same time the best at everything. They have to be artists, athletes, academics, and top of the class in all of the above. And there's a feeling, I think, for a lot of parents out there, and I'm a parent myself, I'm a father of two children, that you know, it's a tough world and only an alpha child can survive. So it's like parenting has become all or nothing. Your child is either in Mensa, aged 8, he's then a Rhodes Scholar, he's in an Ivy League school, and then he's on the front cover of Time magazine, or you know, he's sleeping rough under a bridge in downtown Dallas. And if, I think that feeling of, you know, one or the other, that it's all or nothing, creates this scenario where parenting now, I think, has become a bit like a cross between competitive sport and product development.
Well, you know, we just had a biographer on yesterday, Carl, who wrote about the marriage of Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, lost two sons in their childhood. And it drove home how real the risks used to be to kids' lives, you know, before modern medicine and sanitation. I wonder if our worrying now is some sort of vestigial anxiety that just exists in our genes.
Well, certainly anxiety has always been there. And one of the things I found most fascinating about writing and researching this book was digging back through the history and discovering that however far you go back, I mean, you can go back to the, you know, Assyrian clay tablets or Roman times, you hear parents voicing the same anxieties and fears and fantasies and hang-ups then as you do today. So a lot of these worries and things have been hardwired in. They're just a part of the parenting deal. They will always be there. The problem, I think, in this generation is that they have all been amped up and that the keynote now of child-rearing seems to be anxiety, that it's everything seems to be driven by fear, anxiety, worry, and a kind of hysteria. And we've really stumbled into a very unique moment in the global history of childhood. It's not just the United States. This is something you find right around the planet at the moment.
Yeah. How different are our child-rearing techniques today as compared with the way they've been for essentially eons before right now?
You mean the United States or just everywhere?
Well, I guess Globally, because it is interesting to read that this is not just an American phenomenon.
Usually
we're uniquely qualified to mess up our kids.
Yeah, it's a relief in a way. I mean, I certainly when I embarked on this project, my first suspicion was that this was really just a kind of American thing. But it's not. You know, even in Scandinavia, you know, we think of Scandinavians as being gloriously relaxed and laid back, and they've got everything in perfect harmony and balance. But they've been infected by this hyperparenting bug as well. They talk about curling parents, you know, the sport curling, because you imagine mom and dad frantically sweeping the ice in front of their child's stone to create this perfect path into adulthood. So this is very much something you find everywhere. I found myself having the same conversations with parents and teachers and sports coaches everywhere I went, whether it was the Far East, North and South America, or anywhere in Europe. So this is something that's everywhere. Now, you asked about what has changed with our in this generation. I think that the key shift is that we are hovering and helicoptering and micromanaging every detail of our children's lives in a way that really has never, ever happened before in history. And that's right the way through from schools, the way schools are run now. They're run as almost like assembly lines where kids are stuffed with academic learning and then tested over and over and over again. Or officialdom, strangling children with safety regulations, you know, banning high-risk activities like tag and snowball fights and marbles even. And then it runs right through to the way the consumer juggernaut, you know, advertisers and marketers are all over kids in a way that even 10 years ago would have been unthinkable, you know, holding sleepovers where they test new products on on tweens and hanging around in playgrounds with clipboards and asking kids questions and trying to make sense of their behavior to sell them more stuff. And then, of course, in the home, which is where we as parents are on the front line of child rearing, and we are handling and guiding and supervising and structuring and scheduling and measuring all of these moments of our children's lives, again, in a way that we've just, with an intensity that's just never been there before. So that I think, is where we've arrived at the moment.
Well, I have to wonder, you know, most people our age were not parented this way.
No.
And obviously we want all these different experiences for our kids. I wonder if this is a manifestation of adults today being sort of unhappy with their own lives and thinking, if only I'd had these things, that would have ensured that I didn't feel the ennui or dissatisfaction or anxiety that I feel about my own life right now.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of backing into this. Certainly, that, again, is something, if you go back in history, parents have always lived a little bit through their children. And often, I think, just naturally, we see our kids as a chance to relive our own childhoods or maybe make up for mistakes that we made. And that's, I think, a natural thing. But again, it's a question of intensity and how far it's gone in this generation. I think for a lot of parents now, their children are kind of little mini-me. You know, they carry, they're a vessel that carry all of our hopes and dreams. And you even find a lot of parents now talking about their kids in the collective pronoun, you know, saying, we are going
soccer.
To soccer
right.
camp this year, or we have a lot of homework this weekend, or we are applying to Harvard. And that line is blurred in a way that I don't think is very common in anywhere in history. And you find, I know myself, I go to, you know, barbecues in the neighborhood, or I'm standing around the water cooler with other parents, and a lot of parents have just one topic of conversation. They talk about their kids and what their kids are doing in volleyball and school, and everything gets percolated and filtered through their children. And I think often we're dissatisfied with our own lives, and our own lives nowadays are especially stressful. We've got so little time for ourselves and for our partners that maybe in some ways we're living through our children now much more than we have ever before. And I think when we sit down and think about it, we can realize that that's maybe not an entirely healthy thing to be doing.
Yeah, and kids are so incredibly scheduled right now. There is no what I like to call big fat quantity time in most yeah. kids' lives.
Well, I think that's a symptom of where we are now, is that we don't want to let things just happen. We have to get in there and structure them and put them on a treadmill and make them scheduled, and they have to be packaged so they'll appear on a resume. And we're afraid of downtime, of unstructured time, and we're afraid of that in our own lives as adults. So it's a kind of, every society ends up with a childhood and child development that reflects its own strengths and failings, and we've ended up with a childhood that reflects our own fast-forward, always-on, plugged-in, always-scheduled culture. And kids now, I mean, you find children doing so many extracurriculars that they're even being yanked out of, you know, ballet early to get to tennis on time. And you hear a lot of parents describing, with a mixture of wonder and sadness, that their children falling asleep on the back seat of the car en route to an extracurricular because they're just so tired. And I think there's something really precious and transcendent and timeless is being squeezed out of the equation here, which is just free time. You know, time for children to explore the world on their own terms, to learn how to play and invent, to get bored even. You know, boredom is not a bad thing. You know, it's often the springboard to inventing games or coming up with stories or learning how to create, which are all wonderful things in and of themselves, but also equip people for life in the 21st century economy. So, you know, it works both ways, that free time is such an important part of being a child. And you know that famous bit of gentle poetry from William Blake, who talked about childhood as seeing a world in a grain of sand and holding infinity in the palm of your hand, that thing that children can do, they can disappear into a moment and just vanish. You know, you're walking down the street, your six-year-old daughter spots a ladybug on a rose bush, and she can stop and stand there for 20 minutes, you know, giving the ladybug a name, weaving a story, a narrative around the ladybug scampering up and down the rose petal, and just be there, seeing that world in a grain of sand. But we see that and we think, that's a waste of time. that's slacking. And in fact, we've got to get to ballet, so we drag her off. And I think there's a real, we lose that simple joy of being a child, but we also lose all the developmental payoffs that come with allowing children to hold infinity in the palm of their hand.
some of it, I guess, too, is about consumer culture, because you're telling that story. I happen to have a 6-year-old daughter, and she got interested in butterflies. And so instead of just noticing them when they were out there, we went out and got her one of those kits where you grow the butterflies. And it's great. I actually would highly recommend it as a toy. But it's one of those things where I felt like it was, you know, like it becomes our duty to enhance that experience instead of letting that be her thing.
Exactly. I mean, that's a very natural thing now, is we feel that we see something, we see a little shred of potential or interest, and we jump on it. We feel it has to be formalized and ratcheted up. And if we're spending money on it, so much the better.
It must be better.
Yeah. It must be good. And, you know, there is a place for that kind of kit, and that can be a wonderful springboard for your daughter to get deeper into ladybugs. But I think that it's a question of balance. You know, you don't want to be doing that with every little flicker of interest mm-hmm. that she displays. You know, sometimes just let it, you know, she gets interested in butterflies. So she gets interested in worms or something. You maybe don't rush out and buy her a worm kit. You just kind of let that one go. So I think it's about, you know, flitting back and forth and finding different registers and trying to find yourself somewhere in the middle.
And you actually had an experience like this with your son. A teacher said he was a gifted artist.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was awful. I went to the art room at a parent-teacher evening for my son, who at the time was 7. He's now 9. And the teacher was just gushing about him and said, oh, he's wonderful, and here's a picture of his on the wall. We use it as a model for other pupils. And I was thinking, yeah, this is great. And then she dropped what I think of as the G-bomb, and she said, he's gifted. And it was almost like I didn't hear anything else after that. I just saw that word gifted up in neon, and suddenly I knew I was raising the next Picasso. So what do? I rushed home. I got on Google. I found him an art tutor. And I said to him the next morning, you know, I've got this art tutor who's going to nurture this gift. He's going to polish your art and turn it into an achievement. And my son, thankfully, just said, no. You know, he said, I love to draw, and I just want to draw. Why do I have to have a tutor? And then he asked me the question that feels a bit like the coup de grace, and it was really the starting point for writing this book. He said, why do grown-ups always have to take over everything? And it was one of those moments of searing epiphany when I suddenly saw myself in sharp relief, and I thought, whoa, you know, he's right. I am trying to take over, and I'm in danger of becoming one of these pushy parents you read about in the newspapers. And that, for me, was the starting point, and then I just went off around the world investigating and seeing that, you know, what the way out of this was, and discovering that more and more people are challenging this stifling pressure cooker approach to child rearing and are easing off and finding that children thrive a lot more.
Journalist Carl Honoré is my guest. His book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. One reason we're able to do this, I guess, is that we only have one or two kids today.
Yeah. Well, the question, I suppose, is why we have backed ourselves into this position. And I think there are several things at play here. There's a kind of perfect storm. You have the culture of soaring expectations in this consumer society. We want everything perfect. We want a perfect child to go along with our perfect teeth and perfect kitchens and perfect holidays. And then, there's more uncertainty in the marketplace, the workplace, so we want to push our kids to give them a competitive advantage. But underlying a lot of this are these demographic shifts. Smaller families mean you just have more time to invest in each child. And there's another demographic dimension here as well, which is that we're having children older than ever before. And that means two things. One, if you imagine a woman having her first baby at 20 versus a woman having her first baby at 20, you know, at 39 and a half, there's a big difference there.
It's an entire life.
You know, that 39 and a half year old's probably thinking, phew, just skidded into the finish line here, got my baby, and I've maybe spent a lot of money getting pregnant, and now I'm going to make the most of it. You know, I'm going to maximize my investment here. So there's that. But there's also the fact that as mothers and fathers, we arrive at parenting generally after many years in the workplace, and that means we think, how do we parent better? Well, we'll just do what we do at work. We'll bring in the experts, we'll spend a lot of money, and we'll put in a lot of hard work. You know, we will professionalize parenting. And I think that explains a little bit, or a great deal, in fact, about how we've ended up where we have.
So we basically need to lay off a little bit, is what you're saying. Carl Honoré is my guest. His new book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Carl Honoré. He wrote the book In Praise of Slowness. His new one is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. You can send us email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. What do we know about the outcomes for kids who were raised in pretty laid-back environments as opposed to those who are hyperparented?
Well, I think the research, the anecdotal evidence points to the fact that if kids have some space to breathe, some oxygen, if things are a bit more laid back, they're not in a pressure cooker environment, that they come out, they thrive. They're healthy physically because they've had the exercise, the space to run around. They're confident. They're self-starters. They're very good at socializing because they haven't had an adult always hovering around or picking teams for baseball and sorting out arguments. You know, they're able to work in teams. Better in the workplace, and also they have a kind of industriousness about them. They expect to, I think, to work hard and earn things rather than have everything served up on a silver platter. So they don't turn up at their first job and expect to be on the board later, which I think is part of the problem. What you're seeing on the other side of the equation, which is that if you think of all of the time, money, and energy that we're plowing into our children, we should be seeing the emergence of the happiest, healthiest, brightest, greatest kids the world has ever seen, but that's not what's happening. I think on the micromanaging end, you're ending up with children who are more obese than we've ever seen before. You see young athletes, children suffering sports injuries at younger and younger ages, and of course now child depression and anxiety and the suicide, self-harm, and self and substance abuse that go along with it are now most common not in the urban ghettos where families are struggling to make ends meet, or in the more laid-back families. They're happening in the leafy suburbs where go-getting middle-class families are project-managing their kids and piling on the pressure. And what you find now is that the kids who are coming out, the spearhead of this generation is now starting to come out the other end of this sausage factory. And they struggle to stand on their own two feet. So you hear college professors describing scenarios where they're sitting in a tutorial with a 19-year-old, a 19-year-old, incidentally, with a stellar, scintillating, and unbelievable resume. The kid gets a bit frustrated, flustered, he whips out the cell phone, hits speed dial, and hands it over to the prof and says, well, sort this out with my mom. and of course, the umbilical cord remains intact even after graduation for a lot of these micromanaged children. That you've got parents turning up at job interviews for helping to negotiate salary and vacation packages, and companies see which way the wind is blowing. They're issuing parent packs and holding open parent days so mom and dad can check the office out and make sure it's okay for junior.
Wow.
So, this is the fallout from where we're going too far, and I think, it's alarming.
So the umbilical cord has gone wireless.
Yes. Well, that's what someone recently described the cell phone as, the longest umbilical cord ever invented. And you do see it, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being in touch with your parents, and I think it's wonderful to call your mom and to share your problems with your dad, but I think if you're always turning to them, if they're speed dial, number one, and you're always calling them whenever anything goes wrong and calling them in for help, then something has gone a bit too far. You've lost your bearings.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Carl Honoré is my guest. The book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris and Carl.
Hi.
I have both a challenge and a caveat to you. I have four children between the ages of 15 and 20. Almost 21, one just out of college. My challenge is, one of you is saying, maybe adults right now aren't so happy with their own lives, sort of living through their children, or they have to manage their children, kind of displacing their own unhappiness. I would turn that around and say, maybe for the first generation ever, maybe overstating it, we really like our kids and our kids really like us. We like being with them, they like being with us. Maybe it's a millennial kind of phenomenon, but, I don't dispute your basic premise about over-managing kids, but don't take it so far as to think that actually these families, the kids and the parents actually can't like each other. And I see it in my family where actually, we're not friends with our kids, but they like us and we like them as people and we enjoy being with them. My caveat to you is, and it comes back from your own example of your gifted child, three of my four children are learning different. And one of the things you have to do early on with learning different children is find what their strengths are and play to those strengths, because they can get very frustrated in the traditional academic or school system. So by being hypervigilant and finding what they're good at and reinforcing it helps them get a foothold in life that they ordinarily wouldn't have, especially if you depend on institutions to take care of them.
Thanks for that perspective, John. What do you
sure.
think, Carl?
Thank you. No, I'm glad that John has brought up both of those points, especially the first one. Because, I mean, we've talked a lot about the downside of parenting culture and the way we've wound ourselves up into this culture of overmanagement. But it's not all bad, and there are a lot of wonderful things about being a child in the early 21st century. And I think the technology and the new frontier of the Internet is magnificent. There's a lot of good there. And I think that closeness that John's talking about that exists between parents and children now, that easy informality, that liking one another as people, is probably unique in history, or certainly more pronounced now than ever before, and I think it's magnificent. You know, I have a very different relationship with my children, and I think that's utterly to be celebrated and to be defended. I think the problem is that it can slide too far, and a lot of parents now. You said, you know, we're not friends with them. I think you said, John, but a lot of certainly the polling, and you hear a lot of parents talk about being their kid's best friend, and I think that's when it gets a little too far, because you can't. It's impossible to be a parent and a best friend at the same time, because parents have to say no, and they have to lay down boundaries, and they've got to rein children in, and they've got to discipline them. And I think that's where we bump up against problems, where we move from this wonderful new closeness, which absolutely we should salute and celebrate and defend, into something a bit too claustrophobic, where, you know, it's this sort of Peter Pan generation, where, you know, we don't want to grow old, we dress. We were all in touch with our inner child. I mean, I dress not that differently from my son, who's 9. You know, that's a very different thing. And there's a lot of good things in that, you know, keeping that playful spirit and keeping in touch with your inner child. I think that's all wonderful. But I think, again, it's about striking that balance so that you are still a parent at the end of the day. And that does mean saying no. So the second part of what John was saying was about, especially with children who have learning troubles. I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, and a big part of what I'm saying, not only for that type of children, but for all types of children, is that you do have to be vigilant, and that parenting is often hard work, and you do have to identify where your children's strengths are, and you have to, you know, cultivate them and steer them in directions that will allow those strengths to blossom. Absolutely, I'm not against any of that. Again, it's just a question of degree. I think often we get in there and we see a strength maybe that isn't there. It's maybe a strength that we wish we had, and we're driving the children in that direction. So again, it's about finding the right equilibrium, but both of the points that John makes are absolutely spot on, and I couldn't, in a way, agree more. I'm glad he brought them up, because we hadn't really kind of covered that angle of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Shiza in Southlake. Hi, Shiza.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a very interesting topic, and my question is, how do I know that I am doing at least the bare minimum? I'm, you know, became a mother at 32, so my daughter's almost 2 years old. And while I don't want to be a hyper parent, I would feel that it would be a loss to not take advantage of all that is available there to make sure that I am giving my child some opportunities. But I don't want, you know, how does one find out the middle ground? I mean, is there some insight in your book, or if you can answer?
Yeah, very much so. Thank you. Shiza, is it? Hello.
Yeah.
I mean, but the first thing to bear in mind is that there is no single magic bullet, and there's not one recipe that I or anyone else can give you that will say, this is exactly how many extracurriculars your child should be doing, and this is when she should be start reading. There is so much uncertainty, and because child rearing is not product development, you know, it's an art. You have to feel your way through it. You'll make mistakes. It's trial and error. And I think that we as a culture, we have to start to get more comfortable with that feeling that we have to just let things go a little bit and feel our way. So that would be the first thing I would say. But there are certainly clear markers that you might be going too far. I mean, I think, you know, if for instance, in the sports, if you're going to youth sports, your child's sports, and you find yourself screaming screaming yourself hoarse and getting into arguments with the referee and coach, then you're probably going too far. If your child is falling asleep on the back seat of the car on the way to an extracurricular, you may be going. If your child had dark circles under his eyes, you know, there are sort of markers that you may be going too far. But really, you need to I think you want to expose your child to all of these opportunities. The world is an extraordinary smorgasbord of experiences and possibilities and avenues that are open, but you can't do it all. No one can do it all. So I think it's important to expose them to it, but not necessarily assume that I think a lot of us do that you have to do it all. So let your child try the different sports, the different instruments and so on, but you know, listen to the child, see how we know our children better than anyone else, and we can tell when a child is fully engaged with an instrument or a sport. I think we do know it when we kind of close out all of the hysteria and we sort of shut out what other parents are doing. We just focus on our own family and what we feel and find that inner voice. And I think you will find it because you, just from what you've said, you're looking for it. And I think that means you will find that middle ground.
I really like the phrase that you used. Raising kids is not like product development, because I think one of the hardest things to do as a parent is to come to that realization that their lives are their lives. They're not the second life that we got that this time we get to control. Those lives belong to even very young children.
Yes, that's right. And I think that, I mean, I use the term product development because I think that the way we often parent now is we think, okay, here is input X and I'll get output Y. But that's just not the way that human beings develop. You know, the children are born with a lot of their own genetic coding that will determine many of their traits and inclinations and tastes and personality. And that's why a lot of what parenting is just helping those things come to the fore and discovering them and enjoying and savoring that uncertainty and that wonder of just discovering and getting to know. I've got two children, and they're both very different. And that's been one of the joys of having a second child, is realizing that actually, you know, a lot of what you do just doesn't matter. You know, that the kids will come to things on their own, and it's best to parent with a light touch. Of course, you've got to get in there, like we were saying earlier, and sometimes you've got to push. Sometimes you've got to push hard. But you don't want to be pushing hard all the time. And that's where we need to be moving away from this idea of product development and understanding that it's a lot more fuzzy and blurry than that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to let you know that we've kind of experienced the same thing that your guest is speaking about. About 3 years ago, we were, I guess, hyper parents. We were involved in all the school activities and after-school activities, and we decided to step back a little bit. We started homeschooling the kids 3 years ago, and really that changed the whole dynamic. The situation in the family, we were able to really relax and slow down. And about 2 years ago, we started RVing full-time, driving around the country. I have a job that allows me to do that. And it has been such a wonderful experience, I think, for the kids and for the family as a whole. And then on the other side of that, we are traveling through Dallas as we speak. We're on our way to the Northeast again. But we had dinner with a lovely family that we've known since the kids were in first grade. Now that one of them is graduating, this child finished, he was, I think, the top three in his high school class. He's a National Merit Scholar. He did a wonderful job, and he's about to go off on a full-ride scholarship. And it seemed what I thought would be a wonderful time in this family's life. During the dinner conversation, the mom expressed a lot of frustration and anger and anxiety about the future. And so I just am glad to not be part of that anymore.
Yeah, well, drive safe. That's a great story. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, John. Yes, I mean, homeschooling is something that I look at in the book, and it's obviously not for everyone, but it offers a lot of the room, and it's easier sometimes when you're away from the craziness of the classroom and the other things. You have a bit more control over the rhythms and tempo and shape of your children's day. That a lot of parents who do homeschool find exactly what John has done, that it changes the dynamic, it creates a much more relaxed atmosphere, and that the children really thrive. I mean, they're able to dive into ideas because they feel real passion for it, and they can unleash their curiosity. And then these kids come out the other end of homeschooling, and they do very well. You know, they're often very much sought after by the big universities because they know that they're kids who know how to learn and how to teach themselves and how to learn forever and how to fall in love with learning and all of these things that sometimes get squeezed out of the state and the mainstream school system because everybody's so obsessed with timetables and targets and tests and marks and so on. So that's very much the case. And that, just to follow up on that point of that child who'd got the Fulbright and so on and the mother who's still anxious, I mean, that's a very useful metaphor, I think, for the way a lot of us feel nowadays, that it's almost like nothing is ever good enough. You know, nothing is ever good enough. Your child can be an absolute superstar like the child that was just described, and somehow we still feel like we're not doing enough. And I think that's another symptom of the culture, but also another marker of maybe falling into hyperparenting, is the feeling that you're never doing enough and you're never good enough. And that's caustic. It's corrosive. It erodes our joy in being parents, and I think it gets in the way of a healthy childhood. And there's a wonderful quote from Voltaire, the French writer, who said once, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. And I think that's something to hold on to as a parent, because there's no such thing as a perfect child, but there are a lot of very, very good children, and embrace the good and let the perfect float away, I think.
We have an email from John who writes, I'm 42 and went through elementary school in the late 70s and cannot recall the fortress mentality that now seems to pervade elementary and middle schools. I work as an auto appraiser, and on at least three occasions while inspecting a vehicle for a staff or faculty member, I have been confronted with hostility and suspicion just for being in the vicinity. Schools today are locked down like prisons, and I can't help but wonder what sort of message this sends to the children.
Yeah, that's very true, and that's such a global thing as well. You find schools all around the world are like mini prisons. You know, they've got their adults have to sign in, and there are cameras everywhere. And I think that is an expression of this general fear that we have around children. We feel the world is a terrifying cesspit of, you know, pedophiles and traffic jams and cars and people, drunk drivers and so on. And of course, in a lot of ways, there are dangers out there. But the world, in many ways, is not any more dangerous than it's ever been. And in some ways, it's a lot safer. But it doesn't feel that way to parents. And so there's a kind of paranoia around children. They get wrapped in cotton wool. They're not allowed to take any risks. And I think that the question was, what kind of message does that send to children? I think it sends two messages. One is that, weirdly, at a time when we're trying to cultivate risk-taking as a very important element of success in the global economy, we're actually legislating risk out of our children's lives, and we're encouraging them to avoid risk at all costs. And we're also sending another message, which I think is also unhealthy in different ways, and we're saying that you can't trust any adult. Any adult that you don't know personally is a potential pedophile, and I think that's a very undermining and uncomfortable thing to be sending children out into the world with, the idea that you can't trust anyone. Everyone is stranger danger, and I think that's sad.
Carl Honoré is my guest. His new book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. We'll return in just a moment, and you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or jot an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Carl Honoré. His new book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Our Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Grapevine and talk to Barbara. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. One thing I haven't heard you address yet in these overscheduled children is sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. And I have friends who are school teachers who talk about kids like in middle school just falling over at their desk literally and just falling into a sound sleep. And when I tend to eat out late, I'm maybe 8 o'clock at night, and there'll be very young children that at that age I was already in bed, and I can't see how they're getting a proper night's sleep that way.
Yes, I think that's very much another problem that children are going through now is just lack of sleep. It's all of us. I mean, we're a chronically underslept society, but children, of course, need sleep probably even more than adults do. They certainly need more sleep, because it's when children are asleep that a lot of the processing of what they've learned during the day goes on, a lot of growing happens, and they can't cope if they're not sleeping enough. And part of the reason, I think, for the fact that children are not sleeping as much as they did even a generation ago is that they are so busy. You know, they're coming home after maybe two extracurriculars or three in an afternoon after school, and then they've got homework. And then it doesn't even stop then. They go into their bedrooms, and a lot of kids' bedrooms now resemble the flight deck of the Starship Enterprise. You know, it's just full of, you know, TV screens and PlayStations and all of that stuff that's so stimulating and distracting that they probably log another 90 minutes online, you know. And I think that by the time they go to sleep, they're just simply not getting enough. And that's another problem. And another part of the solution here is to that less is more. You know, you cut back on the extracurriculars, that school systems ease back on the homework. And I think that children, certainly for parents, that's one thing we need to be doing more. And I see it, starting to see it in my own home, is saying no to the technology. You know, that these gadgets are wonderful, but kids are spending way too long on them. I mean, it's up to nearly 7 hours a day, I think, by some estimate, sitting in front of a screen. That's just too much.
Well, and there's so much research now linking not just screen time, but sleep deprivation specifically with obesity.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of what people are doing, a lot of what children are doing when they're not sleeping and when they should be, is that they're just sitting in front of a screen. And there's a clear correlation there on two levels. One, I think that when you're sitting in front of a screen, you're not burning any calories. So that's the obvious link. But the other one is that if you're sitting in front of a TV screen, particularly, and you're getting bombarded by advertising messages telling you to eat nachos and go get a burger and all of that, that there's a clear link between all of, you know, being bombarded by all of these eat more ads and actually eating more. So the two things that go hand in hand and are very much a part of this phenomenon of expanding young waistlines.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to, I think it's Neka in Dallas.
Hi, this is Neka.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
Hi.
I think I'm in agreement with what the guest speaker is saying, because I was raised in Nigeria, and in the society there, when kids are at a certain age, you know, much younger age, we do more of playing than learning. And from playing, we learn a lot. We become really independent. I've been in this country for 13 years, and I have two kids. And I see that this environment is more structured in the sense that at a certain age, a child should be at a certain level. I have a son who is 8 years old, and I'm really having a hard time with the school because all he thinks about is play. I see that as part of a normal growing up for kids back home in Africa. But here, it's more difficult for me because I get called by the principal or the school teacher for the slightest thing, which I take as, you know, normal behavior for kids. It's not fighting, it's not hitting anyone. He's just been a kid, but, you know, it's not allowed in this environment. It's kind of too structured for kids. And at some point in time, I think they want me to put him on medication, which I know that I will never do because they're saying he has ADHD. But I just feel that this environment is too structured for kids, and we should allow kids to be kids.
Well, Neka, thank you so much for your call. I'm sure you're not alone in how you're feeling. Carl, what do you think?
I think she's absolutely right. I mean, it's clear from all of the scientific research and from everything we know intuitively that play is, I mean, to use that phrase from Montessori, play is a child's work. You know, it's joyous, it's wonderful, it's fun, but it's also how children start to make sense of the world. It's how they knock their young and developing brains into shape. It's how they learn how to socialize. It's how they learn how to be human beings. And we've crowded play out of their lives, especially, I mean, free play. You know, the play that they get now is spoon-fed to them. It's structured. It's measured. It's supervised. It's directed by adults.
Rules and a helmet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's also sort of all the risk is removed from it. So the rough and tumble goes as well. And I think that it drains a lot of the value from the play. And what that caller, Mecca, was saying is absolutely the case, that you find the flip side of that equation is that we're now uncomfortable with free play or with boisterous play. It looks threatening to us. It looks wild and untamed. So what do? Well, we take the extreme measure of micromanagement, which is we reach for the medicine cabinet. And you see right around, the United States has been leading the way on this, but you find it around the world now, this medicating of children to control their behavior and their mood, to make it conform to what we think they should be doing, rather than stepping back and wondering if it's the problem lies with us and our prejudices and our inability to cope with that kind of open-ended play and that, you know, rough and tumble and that inattention sometimes. I mean, being inattentive is part of being a child part of the time, but we just don't want to know about that. Now, it doesn't fit with our model and our paradigm, so we rush in and micromanage even with drugs.
Well, I remember reading years ago about the Puritans and how they used to dress their children like tiny adults. And from a very young age, they expected these children to have sort of adult reverence for certain things and adult work ethics. And I remember thinking that was just horrible and so unnatural. And in an odd way, because everything's sort of colored by the Disney Corporation, but we're doing the same thing today.
We are. It's funny, you mentioned the Puritans. They're, in some ways, the one other moment in history when parents really got down that hyper-parenting route. I mean, it's a different, obviously a different world, and they didn't have nearly the tools at their disposal that we have today. But there's a clear echo. And yes, you see people now, we're all wearing the same clothes, and there's a kind of blurring of the generational lines. And in some ways, that can be wonderful. That can be liberating for both adults and in some ways for children, too, that it, you know, that it's less infantilizing for kids in some ways. But I think also it's a dangerous, it's a slippery slope, because there is a difference between adults and children. Children are children and adults are adults. And I think we've kind of blurred that line a little bit, and to our detriment. You know, children need... We all need to remember that children are children, and that they may be able to strike the poses of the adult world and wear adult clothes and even use adult jargon and lingo, but they, especially in the early years, are not fully equipped to deal with all of the emotions and stress that goes along with acting out those roles and being an adult. And I think we need to hold on to that and remember it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line is Lee in Dallas. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Yes, I have a question and a quick statement. Have you found that there are geographical differences in this child-rearing scheduling? Now, example is, I have a therapist friend here in Dallas who says, has told me that East Coast parents do the very same things we do in Dallas, with one exception. They don't hold their children's mistakes. They turn them loose. And my statement, I was 38 when we had our first son, an only child. He's 24 years old now. And last year, as a 23-year-old, I went to him and said, I'm going to ask you to forgive me for making you a prisoner of the system. Went on camps everywhere, all over the world, you name it, he did it. But he's been a long time finding himself in college. And I think the point of that being, for the first time in 6 years of college, and he's done well, he called me last week with his grades, because he always knew, I think, that no matter what his grades were, I would not be accepting of them.
That's interesting, yeah. I mean, it's... How did that conversation go? Did he?
You know, we don't have Lee on the line anymore.
We don't.
I'm sorry.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that I hear similar stories from parents all over the place. I mean, I'll answer the first question from Lee, which was about the geographic differences. I think that you find, broadly speaking, this hyper parenting culture, I think, is maybe more pronounced in cities, because the competition, the heat, the thermostat is just set higher on everything there, and there are more things on offer, and there's less space for letting kids run free outside. But I find that the same, I mean, we're all part of the same culture, and you do find, even in small towns or smaller towns or even in the country, you still find parents doing that micromanagement. They maybe do it a bit less, but if they do it less, they sometimes feel a bit guilty about it. So we're all kind of caught up in the same swirl, I think, and you move out of the United States, and the same thing happens. I'd say that the cities, it's more intense, but you go to the countryside and you still find parents caught up in the same mania.
Do you ever have moments where you sort of panic a little bit and think, oh no, if they're not in music theory and all that, then they really will be behind all their classmates?
I had that moment just last week, actually. I was standing in the playground, and my daughter's six, and one of her classmates' mother said, overheard her saying that this classmate had just signed up for violin. And my first reaction was, oh no, my daughter's not in violin. You know, that was my reflex. And I think that's natural. I think that's the knee-jerk reflex nowadays. But in the past, I think I probably would have taken that reflex and run with it, which is what a lot of us do. We would run off and got our daughter into violin without really thinking about it. But I had a kind of second reflex, which was to say, okay, that's fine, that child's in violin. What does violin mean for my daughter now? Does it make sense for our family in this moment? And I thought about it, and I decided it didn't. And so my daughter didn't get enrolled in violin. But I still had that little flicker, that rush of worry and anxiety. And I think, really, when we're talking about how to conquer this inner hyperparent that we all have, it's about recognizing that you're always going to have that natural reflex. You're always going to have that little panic, knee-jerk feeling. But not to go with it, to take a deep breath and just stop and look at the big picture and ask yourself, what is it about this moment that, you know, that I should do best? What's going to work for my family at the moment? And that's a huge relief, really, to do that. And it does seem to work for people.
So is it sort of like fighting an addiction, that you're always going to have moments where you're really tempted to lapse back into what you were before?
I think it's like being on the wagon and falling off it. You know, it's always going to be there. And that's because these anxieties, a lot of them are hardwired into us. You know, we want the best for our children, and that's great. That's a wonderful instinct. We ought to cultivate it and celebrate it. But we don't want it to take over everything, and we don't want ourselves to be taking over everything in our children's lives and micromanaging every detail. So you just need to be alert to the fact that you're going to have those little flashes of panic, those little itch to jump on the treadmill and start overtaking the Joneses next door. But you want to have a second reflex that comes in automatically afterwards that says, wait, stop, take a deep breath and look around and ask yourself, you know, the hard questions. Is this right? What do I do? And go from there. So, yes, it is very much like an addiction.
So I want to ask you this, Carl. We haven't had a single call today, not a single person defending sort of hyperparenting and saying, "What you're crazy. My kid needs SAT prep and soccer and music theory and whatever, pottery. So if everyone sort of agrees that all this is crazy...
Well, I think that... I mean, there may be some people who don't. I mean, I wouldn't say that everybody does. But I think that most of us feel that something has gone wrong, that we've lost our bearings in our own homes a little bit, and culturally, that something in them is just not right. We've lost our compass. And often it's like we're engaged in a Mexican standoff where we're all looking at each other thinking, okay, we all know something's wrong here, but who's going to jump first? You know, who's going to step off that treadmill? Who's going to say, no, let's just slow this down, let's think of it in a different way first? And in a way, that's really why I wrote the book, was to give people the confidence to know that, you know, it's going to be okay. It will be okay. You don't have to go all the time. You don't have to be a perfect parent. You can be a very good parent, and your child will thrive, and everybody will be a lot happier and healthier as a result. So it's kind of about breaking through that Mexican standoff and getting people to take the first step, and also to reach out to other people. And you find when you start having these conversations that often it's the perfect alpha mom in the playground, the one who seems to be doing it all and having it all and got the kids on the alpha track, who's also having these doubts and thinking, you know, is this really what I wanted for my child and for me? And she's increasingly saying to herself, no. So how do I get out of it? And that's kind of what the book is about, is looking how do we get out of it collectively, rethinking our school systems and consumerism and technology, but also individually in our own homes. Where do we start backing off and easing off this pressure to let children have the space and time to be children?
Carl Honoré's fascinating new book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Children from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Carl, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.